It's Philosophy Talk.
Do you believe in God?
The question is, does God believe in me?
What is religious belief?
Harry, do you believe in God?
Never met him.
Yeah, well, I do. And I love Jesus' style.
What does it really mean to believe in God?
Isn't believing in God a little like believing in the Tooth Fairy or Santa Claus?
Do you believe in God?
Yes.
Oh.
We believe in quarks and gluons even though we don't see them with our eyes, so why not believe in God too?
So is it a problem that I'm not really religious?
Not for me.
Why not?
I'm not the one going to hell.
Is believing in God a form of self-deception?
I know you don't believe in God. You don't believe in the power of prayer, and that's okay. To each his own. But you've got to believe in something.
Our guest is Neil Van Leeuwen from Georgia State University.
What is religious belief?
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
On Wednesday, May 29th, come be part of a live recording of Philosophy Talk on the Stanford campus.
We'll be thinking about the Doomsday Doctrine with writer, activist, and former military planner Daniel Ellsberg.
This event is free and open to the public. More information at philosophytalk.org.
That's Wednesday, May 29th, 7 o'clock at Cubberly Auditorium on the Stanford campus.
Daniel Ellsberg on Philosophy Talk.
Does anyone really, truly believe in God?
Or is religion just a fancy form of make-believe?
Don't we all believe some things on faith?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ken teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
And today, we're thinking about religious beliefs and asking how they differ from other kinds of beliefs.
How they differ? I'll tell you one way they differ, Ken. They're more philosophically disreputable.
Disreputable? Come on, Josh, why do you say that?
Well, they're not based on evidence or reason. They're not subject to debate. You can't prove or disprove them. I mean, I think religious belief is a lot more like, you know, self-deception or make-believe.
Oh, gosh, Josh. I think you're way underestimating religious people. And also their beliefs. Look, religious beliefs can have huge impacts on people. Some of the most honest, committed, and passionate people I know are the way they are precisely because of their religious beliefs. So they can't possibly just be like make-believe.
Well, I mean, it could be wishful thinking. Maybe they believe it, but it isn't true. Or maybe they only believe they believe it.
What are you talking about?
Well, think about all the stuff that religious people actually do. Well, maybe not all of them, but some of them. You know, they tell us to love our neighbor, and then what do they do? They go out and vote for a guy who puts kids in cages.
Well,
right? They go on and on about sexual purity, and then they cheat on their spouses. And, I mean, surely that kind of thing has to mean they don't really believe the stuff they say. They just think they believe it.
No, Josh. Look. You're making a bad difference. Lots of people are like that, they're precisely like that, about lots of their beliefs. For example, there are plenty of people who believe, getting more exercise and eating better would be good for their health. But, you know, they don't always follow through. But that doesn't mean that they don't believe, really truly believe that they should. It's like, you're the literary guy. It's like that line from T.S. Eliot, I think. He says, between the intention and the act falls the shadow.
That is a beautiful line. Okay, so you're saying people like that are subject to what philosophers call weakness of the will.
That's exactly right. And all of us, even you, Josh, I'm sure, even you, are subject to weakness of the will sometimes.
Fair point.
So why would you pick on religious people and their religious beliefs as particularly bad examples?
Well, because there really is a difference. I mean, look, I genuinely believe that it's good for me to get more exercise, even if I'm, you know, lying on my couch eating Cheetos.
Yeah.
But I'm not as convinced, Ken, that gun-loving Christians actually believe, for example, in turning the other cheek. You know, maybe they say they do. Or maybe they're trying to convince other people. Maybe they're trying to convince themselves. But are they really believing it?
Oh, but just ask yourself. Come on. Why on earth would people spend all that time, all that intellectual energy, trying to talk themselves into pretending that they believe something that they really don't believe? What would be the point?
Well, Nietzsche has an answer for that, actually. He thinks people often prefer illusions to the truth because the truth is really hard to swallow. Look, illusions make life more palatable. They make things look better than they actually are. And you know what? People need that.
Josh, come on. You really believe that religious belief is just nothing but like a Nietzschean necessary illusion or something?
Thus spoke Zarathustra, Ken. I mean, look, believing in an all-powerful, all-knowing, eternal being in the sky who has some big plan for you, that's a really comforting illusion. I mean, it sure beats the heck out of recognizing the world's just a cold, hard, meaningless place and death is the end of existence.
You say, yeah, okay, I get it. You say religious belief is oh so comforting, so easy. But come on, think about it a little more. Think of what religion sometimes requires of us. It says you got to give away your money. You got to sacrifice your life. And in the case of Abraham, you know what God said to Abraham? Give me your child, son, the one I promised you. Take him and sacrifice him. You think that was comforting to Abraham? That was demanding, dude.
Well, I'll grant you that religious belief is a complicated phenomenon. Yeah. There's clearly a lot we need to figure out. Maybe it would help if we could get God on the line.
Oh, Josh, I know you're joking, but, you know, there are people who seriously believe that they're in an actual conversation with God. So we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to find out how some evangelical Christians try to forge an intimate relationship with an invisible divine being. She files this report.
Tanya Marie Lerman grew up in an Orthodox Jewish neighborhood. Her mother's father is a Baptist minister. Her father was raised as a Christian Scientist. So she's always been fascinated by how things become real for people.
My first project, my dissertation project, was on middle-class people who practice magic.
Now she's an anthropologist at Stanford. By 2003, she began doing fieldwork with an evangelical church called the Vineyard.
In this faith, people seek to have a back-and-forth relationship, an intimate relationship with this all-powerful, all-knowing, entirely good God who responds to them.
She spent more than 4 years observing the Vineyard in Chicago and Palo Alto in prayer groups, Bible circles, and worship sessions.
And they would say things like, I recognize God's voice the way I recognize my mom's voice on the phone.
But she says Vineyard members didn't necessarily act like they could rely on an all-powerful God, at least not in the same way people rely on mom. In fact, they often talked about forgetting God was real.
People never ask God to write their term paper. They take their car to be fixed. Most religious believers also go to the doctor.
So Lerman went searching for an explanation to a big question. How are rational people able to feel the presence of an invisible being? That question sent her back in time to the 1960s.
One of the great untold stories of American Christianity is the hippie Christians, or the Jesus freaks.
Sipping whiskey from a paper cup.
By the 70s, musician Larry Norman had introduced the world to Christian rock.
Take a look at what you've done to yourself. Why don't you put the bottle back on the shelf?
Thousands and thousands of young Christians looked to Jesus as the perfect representation of hippie counterculture.
The people tell me that I'm trying to look like Jesus. I can't think of anybody else I'd rather look like.
An evangelist named Lonnie Frisbee preached on the beaches.
God is blowing everybody's mind because he's saving the hippies. And nobody thought a hippie could be saved. God, if you're really real, reveal yourself to me.
These hippie Christians kind of traded LSD out for speaking in tongues.
Lerman says the Jesus people wanted to connect with God in a meaningful, intimate way. The Vineyard movement spoke about a real God for real people. Decades later, evangelical churches like the Vineyard now dot the United States, and many Americans say they talk to God. Lerman says that at the Vineyard, churchgoers are taught how to hear God's voice.
But they basically invited people to look for thoughts that stood out from other thoughts, thoughts that might be more spontaneous, thoughts that were louder. And they would say, well, you know, you really want to ask, is this the kind of thing that God would say?
This close relationship to God can help keep belief systems strong, and those beliefs can also have political implications. White Christian evangelicals, for example, overwhelmingly voted for President Donald Trump because he spoke about a lot of policies that appeal to this base.
It spoke to a lot of evangelical anxieties in a moment where they're beginning to go and clearly see their demographic decline.
John Bileski is an American religion anthropologist with the University of Edinburgh. He also researched the Vineyard Church, where he met people drawn to the miraculous.
Part of it was that the entire Trump story seemed so unlikely to the degree that people believe there is a divine plan and that people are looking for the hand of God. They're looking for breaks from the natural order.
But Bileski says evangelicals were clearly not the only people looking for an improbable president. And he says that faith in the invisible is not necessarily unique to believers.
So much of what we do in this current world is taken on faith. There's just a vast horizon of material that we don't understand, that we can't explain, and we just hope or expect will be there.
Tanya Lerman says the evangelical Christians she met at the Vineyard seemed happy to feel the presence of such a loving God. But there were some who also felt the disturbing presence of demons.
I thought that the demons could sometimes be pretty overwhelming for people. And those are the people that I became most worried about.
After all, not all invisible forces are good to have around.
Well, it may be the devil, and it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that amazing tour of people trying to hear the voice of God. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy. And today we're asking, what is religious belief?
Ken and I are actually in the studios of the Chicago Recording Company this week. But from our home studio at KLW in San Francisco, we're now joined by Neil Van Leeuwen. Neil is a professor of philosophy at Georgia State University. He's one of the featured contributors on the Philosophy Talk blog. And he's the author of a forthcoming book tentatively titled Religion as Make-Believe. Neil, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
It's great to be here.
So, Neil, I want you to tell us, what first got you interested in this topic? It's a fascinating topic, but what first got you interested? I mean, did you have some religious conversion, religious falling away, hear the voice of God shouting at you or something? What was it?
Well, I grew up in a Protestant family that was really devout. My parents are both professors, but we went to church twice on Sunday and once during the week on Wednesday. And wow. I was always intellectually curious. So I ended up in grad school in philosophy, as you know, as my former advisor. So with this personal background combined with my interest in philosophy of mind, it was sort of inevitable that I would start thinking about, well, what exactly is going on psychologically with religious belief?
So I feel like we should ask you how much grad school corrupted you. I mean, so Ken and I were arguing earlier about religious belief. Ken was saying that religious beliefs are basically just, you know, garden variety beliefs. I was saying they might be a little bit more questionable. So where are you these days after grad school? Who's right?
I lean your way, Josh. I don't think they're garden variety beliefs. Garden variety beliefs are beliefs with usually contents like, I think my bicycle's in the garage. Or, I think this flight is going to leave late. But there's definitely more of a make-believe quality, more of a creative yet still committed quality to religious beliefs. And the way I like to think of it is they're like make-believes that people use to define their identities.
Well, identity. Wait a minute. I guess I get the thing about identity. The thing about make-believe, though, I mean, There's something in the news where in some country they're going to put gays to death because of their religion says, put gays to death, right? And that doesn't sound like, that sounds like deadly serious stuff. That doesn't sound like play acting or fiction or anything like that.
It's a false dichotomy,
like
Ken.
Serious.
False dichotomy. Okay, make-believe can be extremely serious. So people dedicate their lives to fictions. So the fact that religion is something that people dedicate their lives to, at least on Sundays, doesn't mean that it's a garden variety kind of belief. In fact,
but would you kill someone over a Game of Thrones?
Well, I wouldn't.
Or something like that?
I wouldn't. But there's
that's good to know, Neil.
Well, there's an episode on tonight, so we'll see, but I don't plan on it.
Yeah, maybe if you spoil it for me, that could get violent.
But just consider an example of fiction being serious. So after Johann Wolfgang Goethe published The Sorrows of Young Werther, there were copycat suicides that emulated the way Werther killed himself in this novel. So you also hear about people playing World of Warcraft, doing very bad things to themselves, and sometimes even committing suicide and that sort of thing, on the basis of something that is not part of reality. So the first thing to
Wait a minute, slow down. Yeah. When you say not part of reality, just really quickly, you also said something about the identification, about their identity. Isn't my identity part of reality? If I identify something with something, don't I make it part of my reality? Can you tell me that briefly?
Well, your identity is something that's in your mind, but the symbols that stand for your identity, that you have allegiance to, those can be fictional. Those can be like war paint on your face or a certain effigy or image that is imagined rather than real.
Okay, so there's a lot of stuff to untangle here because I want to get at this make-believe versus identity versus all this stuff and how it's all wrapped up with a religious belief, but we'll have to take a break and then reset. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about religious belief with Neil Van Leeuwen from Georgia State University.
What's special about religious beliefs? Are they sincere professions of faith? Are they just wishful thinking? Or is religion an elaborate game of make-believe?
Sacred truths or make-believe? Plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues. What exactly is it about believing in God that takes so long? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and we're thinking about religious belief. Our guest is Neil Van Leeuwen from Georgia State University.
So, Neil, I can tell you've got a complicated welter of thoughts about the nature of a religious belief, and I know you've done a lot of sort of cognitive science-related work on this, but I want to start by you picking out like one of the main features. What is the most significant or surprising or intriguing feature of religious belief that in your mind distinguishes it from ordinary factual beliefs?
Well, I think one simple place to start is that to a large extent, religious credences, as I call them, are voluntary. So people make a voluntary commitment to the resurrection of Jesus. But when it comes to ordinary factual beliefs, like if you see lightning strike in your backyard, it's not a choice to think that lightning just struck in your backyard. That's more of a passive phenomenon. That's just how you take things to be. So factual belief versus religious credence differs in terms of voluntariness.
Well, wait a minute, though. You're talking about being raised in a religious household, as was I. And in one sense, I can see the claim that religious beliefs is voluntary, because when I got to be 16, I said, to heck with that. But in my house, it wasn't voluntary. I mean, certainly going to church wasn't voluntary. Reciting certain prayers wasn't voluntary. I mean, and the authority on the basis of which I believed it, it wasn't my own will. It was like my parents, my preachers, all these authority figures said, believe this, Ken.
Right. And you could add in there things like scripture and revelation, right? So, I mean, you know, we tend to think that religious belief floats free of evidence, unlike lightning. I've got good evidence to say that there's lightning out there. But couldn't a believer say, I've got evidence, you know, God appeared to me, or I've got evidence, I've got the Bible. The Bible is evidence. So it's not a choice. I don't have a choice whether or not to believe it. The evidence is right in front of me.
Well, let me address Ken's point. So people put a lot of pressure on you to believe. But when you actually have evidence-based ordinary beliefs, like your belief that your bike is in the garage or that electricity turns the lights on, you don't have to have someone pressure you. You don't have to work hard at it. Rather, that's something that arises in light of the evidence you have. Now, to Josh's point, sure, people can say that their religious beliefs are evidence-based, but there's actually plenty of evidence from the anthropology that there's also choice going on. So Tanya Lerman, from whom we just heard, mentions this among the Vineyard Fellowship, that people often are making a choice to hear their own thoughts as the voice of God.
It makes sense. Yeah. You were saying earlier that it has to do with a sense of identity. I mean, Emil Durkheim, the anthropologist, thought that religion's primarily or maybe even entirely about that. I mean, is that what you're saying, that I make this choice to believe certain things so that I'm sort of part of a certain group? You know, we're the people who believe that God is three in one or something like that. We believe that. You don't. That's an identity marker. Is that the idea? People are choosing to be part of a group?
Yeah. Religious credences are groupish beliefs, as I put it. That's not the only thing that religious beliefs might do for someone. They also make people feel as if they have a certain purpose. They make people feel happy sometimes. But a large part of it is marking yourself under a certain identity. It's like a badge. I'm the one who believes that Jesus rose from the dead.
So, Neil, I want to make a distinction and see, because part of me agrees with you, part of me I'm not sure, but I think a distinction might help. I believe in lots of things. I believe in my son. I believe in my wife. I believe in Josh. I believe in you.
Thanks.
I sometimes believe in my country. I sometimes doubt my country. That believing in is a kind of commitment, right, that I hold to my belief in something somewhat independently of my evidence, because if my son lets me down or something, or my wife lets me down, I'm disappointed, but I persist in my believing in. That's a form of commitment or faith, right, this believing in. Now, it seems to me that religious belief is a form of believing in, right? It's not necessarily, I mean, there is some believing that God, blah, blah, blah. And there's some complicated relationship between believing in and believing that. But I don't know that as a form of believing in, religious belief is all that different from other forms of believing in.
Sure. Well, I think let's focus on the believing that, because there really are a lot of descriptive statements about the world that appear in religions, right? Just people say they believe that God exists. But even on the believing that side, the religious credences, they function psychologically differently from the factual beliefs. So as Josh was pointing out before, the religious credences only seem to be active in certain special places and in certain special contexts. So you hear this phrase once a week Christian. And there are a lot of analogs in other religions. So people stop acting like God exists when it's not the high holy days, or when it's not Sunday, or when they're not in church, or when they're not being probed about their identity.
But you know what the philosopher Kierkegaard said about those once a week Christians? That's a lazy Christianity.
Right.
That's a lazy, lazy Christianity. True faith, the faith of Abraham, is demanding. It's not a once-a-week thing. It's a thing that takes over your life and leads you to make hard choices and all that.
Ken,
so those once-a-week Christians, Kierkegaard would say, they don't really have belief.
Well,
or they have mere belief but not faith or something.
There's a point implicit in Kierkegaard that I think is really worth drawing out, and that's this. The fact that you have to work at it to be a more than a once-a-week Christian already shows that religious credences aren't like factual beliefs. You don't have to work at it to believe that electricity exists. You don't have to work to act like the lights need to be plugged in to work.
I get you. But that's why I wanted to distinguish between believing in and believing that, right? Believing in God is work. Believing in your country is work. Believing in your spouse is work. And it's important work. It's not make-believe work. It's an investment of your cognitive kind of resources in living a life of a certain kind, right? So believing in is supposed to be work.
Sure. But what's your point? That doesn't show that religious...
That religious belief, you're misunderstanding. You're relating religious belief to sort of factual belief and saying it's not like that, but there's a kind of belief that it is like that does take work and commitment, believing in something. And believing in God is a kind of different orientation than just, oh, I believe that God is this, that, or the other thing. It's a completely different kind of... So, I mean, maybe you're right, but maybe the category is not make-believe. It's more like believing in, right? Because you want to say it's like make-believe, it's like pretend. It's not like pretend or make-believe. It's like believing in something.
Well, so first of all, you granted my main point already. So if you're saying that religious beliefs are different from factual beliefs, that's kind of the main point here. And now we're quibbling about, well, what's the best analog? So I grant you that believing in, which is, by the way, a vague term, is a kind of commitment that people make more than just in religion. But that's right. Fine. The question is, how do people relate to the descriptive things like, oh, let's pick a more traditional religion that does ancestor worship? Well, people, say, in Madagascar will act like their dead ancestors are completely gone when probed in a naturalistic context. But then if you probe them in a ritual context, so in a sacred context, then they'll say things like the ancestor can still hear, can still see, right, and so on. So you get this kind of toggling back and forth. In certain special situations, you act a certain way as if this dead person were still alive. But then most of the time, you act like it's just a dead body. So
that
this
makes sense. I think, you know, we have analogs in thinking, if you think about funerals, where people talk about folks having gone to a better place, and then they leave the funeral parlor and look both ways when they cross the road because they don't want to go to that better place right now.
Right.
But I'm essentially agreeing with you, but I still have a worry about, you know, sort of what Ken was saying about Kierkegaard. Is it really a one-size-fits-all thing here? I mean, are all religious believers sort of the same in this dimension? Or is there maybe a kind of difference of degree? I mean, think about a priest or a preacher or a rabbi or someone who's essentially living that every moment of every day, or a Buddhist monk. I mean, shouldn't we talk about differences in degree here where, some people are once a week Christians, some people are once a year Christians, but some people are kind of every moment of every day Christians. And doesn't that make a difference?
Well, let's distinguish two kinds of degree. One is degree to which your religious beliefs are central to your identity. Another degree is the extent to which you're confident that they're actually true. And those two things come apart and in quite striking ways. And I think the fact that they come apart is important. So if you look back at or listen back to what Tanya Luhrmann was saying, it's very clear that there can be people who, as she put it, forget that God is real. But they're still strong believers in the sense that believing in God is part of their identity. So the fact that there can be that disparity, I think, is a point in my favor, that the strongest believers, so take Ted Haggard, the evangelical preacher who was caught with a meth-dealing male prostitute. Now, he was one of the strongest, quote-unquote, believers. But I think what that shows is that his belief was a very selective make-believe, even if it was important to him.
Well, it could just be weakness of the will of a garden variety sort. Not saying weakness of the will is a non-puzzling phenomenon. But, you know, we've got some callers who want to get into this conversation. And I don't think any of them is the voice of God, but maybe. Ariane in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ariane. What's your comment or question?
Yes, thank you. I have a couple points. The first is that our images of God say more about ourselves than whether God exists or not. When they say in the Bible that man is created in God's image, they could equally say that God is created in man's image. And unfortunately, God is blamed for all kind of human foibles, from rape to war to gross economic disparity. At any rate, when your guest talks about what he believes, it's based on the senses. And there's a form of hubris in that, and it goes unquestioned in a hypermaterialistic age when science itself is worshipped as a religion. I'm not saying that science is without its purpose, but divorced from the larger questions of the universe and what is created. If there's no car or even dictionary that hasn't been created by something or someone, to deny that things are intentionally created when we cannot create an ecosystem seems absurd to me, and it's full of hubris. Yeah.
So, thanks for the comment, Ariane. But Neil, I don't think you're questioning whether, I don't think it's relevant to your study of religious credences whether they're true or not. You're not claiming that they're the kind of things that couldn't possibly be true, or are you?
No, that's not the claim. The claim is that they're processed in a different way, psychologically speaking, and that we need to get clear on what that different way is. So that's the main point. So I'm not actually doing any theology or negative theology or anything like that. It's really a psychologically oriented theory.
And I think that's an important thing. I mean, it's the question of what are the nature of, I'm going to call them cognitions, what are the nature, what is the distinctive nature of religious cognitions, right? Are they like ordinary beliefs, which are some kind of cognitive states? There are all kinds of cognitive states beyond just religious belief and factual belief. There's hypotheses, there's conjectures, right? Imagination is in some ways a cognitive state. So you're just kind of doing the fine-grained psychology of that. Do I have you right or wrong?
That's absolutely right. And let me pick up on a point that Ariane actually made. She was saying that we make God in our image. Now, I think she's right about that. And going back to the Roving Philosophical Report, we saw that the hippie Christians that Tanya Lerman was talking about, they had a hippie God. Now, isn't that interesting? So there's a creative, imaginative element to religious belief that I think is important not to overlook. And that does mark it as a kind of psychological processing that's similar to make-believe.
Yeah, Xenophanes, the ancient Greek philosopher, said if, you know, if horses had gods, they'd look like horses. I'm very persuaded by you that there's a real difference between everyday beliefs and religious beliefs, both in terms of how the beliefs are formed, also in terms of the kind of work they do for us, also in terms of how we evaluate them, all of these things. So here's a question for you. You know, you're someone who has read a lot of empirical psychology. I mean, should we think about these things as belonging to two different systems in the brain? I mean, I read one study that suggested that when you get people to solve math problems and then ask them, you know, whether they believe in supernatural forces, they're less likely than in the in the ordinary context to declare a belief in supernatural forces. Doesn't that suggest that, you know, kind of confirming your thought, we're actually talking about two different kinds of mental system, the system that sort of creates and monitors everyday kinds of belief and the system that creates and monitors religious beliefs?
So I don't actually think that, Josh. And here's why. Just because you have different attitudes doesn't mean it's a whole separate system. So in processing fiction, you use a lot of the same psychological resources for thinking about the mental states of, say, Sherlock Holmes, as you do for thinking about the mental states of Ken Taylor. So whether or not you're using religious credences or you're using factual beliefs, there's going to be a lot of overlapping psychological processes. So I think it's actually a mistake to put them in separate boxes.
We've got another caller on the line, Patty in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Patty. What's your comment or question?
Yeah, good morning. I believe that there's actually two variations on the same thing. You have the communal or societal beliefs, which you're instructed from childhood to follow certain rituals, to do certain things, to have certain beliefs, which may be more superficial than reality. And then you have the individual who looks beyond the rituals and the dogma to find whatever the truth is of that belief.
Okay, thanks for the comment. Neil, you got a quick response to that?
I think the word communal is a great word. When there's traffic on the freeway, you just think there's traffic on the freeway. But when you believe the world was created in 7 days, you're doing that to belong to a community.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about religious belief with Neil Van Leeuwen from Georgia State University.
What attitude should non-believers have towards religious belief? Should they tolerate it, make fun of it, or respect it?
Religious belief and social life when Philosophy Talk continues. Seems like some people don't always respect the religious beliefs of famous singers. I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and our guest is Neil Van Leeuwen from Georgia State University. Today we're asking, what is religious belief?
And we've got a caller in the line, Madeline from El Cerrito. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. What's your comment or question?
Hi. I have a comment. Religion is a crutch. It's a very useful crutch for a lot of people, and it's really nice if you can use it, but I don't have it. But it's a crutch. Because everybody,
you spoke it?
I'm going to die and go to heaven. Your religion is worse than mine. It's always something that people lean on.
Yeah, Madeline, thank you. You're spoken like Nietzsche, as Josh said in the opening, a comforting, useful illusion. Does that follow? I'm not going to ask you. Well, you can opine on that question if you want, Neil. But is your view tantamount to a Nietzschean view? Let's put it that way, that religion is just a comforting illusion.
I wouldn't use the word just. Something's being a comforting illusion can be really powerful. So don't say just a comforting illusion. That's, if it's a comforting illusion, which I think it is in many cases, that doesn't mean that there's something small about it, right? It's one that people take very seriously.
Right, but I assume Nietzsche had the belief that that's all religion could be, because it had no, it seems as though he believed it didn't have the possibility of being true. Or I'm not sure if that's right. I mean, I'm wondering, is your view, this is back to Ariane's question, I thought your view did not have the immediate implication that religious belief couldn't possibly be true. They're not candidates for being true. Would you go that far?
Well, I don't think that's the case. So religious beliefs have lots of different contents, and there have been thousands and thousands of different contents to religious beliefs all over the world. Maybe some of them might be true. Lots of them aren't, probably. But that's not the real question that I'm trying to ask. The question I'm trying to ask is, what are people doing with them in their minds? And to go back to the crutch metaphor, they're doing something differently with their religious beliefs than they do with their ordinary factual beliefs, like about where they live, what their address is, what's in their bank account, and so on.
How are religious beliefs related to another kind of state in our head? Hopes, for example. I hope for an afterlife, right? Let's pretend I hope for an afterlife. I hope for fame. I hope for, you know, good health. I work toward making my hopes real. I don't just hope it happens. I hope to make it happen, right? So how are religious beliefs related to hopes? I mean, nobody would just say a hope is just a crutch, would they? So, or even that a hope is a crutch. Or a hope is an illusion. So why differentiate religious beliefs from hopes?
Well, I think they're both sort of imagination-driven kinds of mental states. So when you hope for something, you picture something that's other than what the ordinary world is actually like. And I think in many ways you're doing the same thing with religious credences. You're coming up with a representation of the world that's different from the ordinary mundane world. And that's kind of the whole point.
Right, exactly. But a mind without that capacity for hope, wouldn't that be an impoverished mind? So instead of, Nietzsche dismissing religious belief as a comforting illusion, isn't that the same as dismissing a hope? I mean, if you were to dismiss it as a mere illusion, by parity of reasoning, should I dismiss hope? I mean, no, of course I shouldn't dismiss hope.
Well, now you're putting me on the hook for something that I don't think I need to sign up for. So I don't think we need to get rid of hope altogether, just to get rid of religious credences. I think the thing to keep in mind is I'm not telling anyone to not have their religious credences. But I think what I would want to say is that they don't belong in the public sphere guiding public deliberation about how to live collective life. So sure, hope away. Sure, practice your religion, but don't impose it on other people who don't share that. Just like you aren't entitled to impose your hopes on other people, you're not entitled to impose your religious credences on people that don't share them.
Keith from San Francisco is on the line. What's your welcome to Philosophy Talk, Keith. What's your comment or question for us?
First of all, I'm wondering if the question might actually be the wrong one. And the question I'm interpreting is, do religious beliefs matter? Might be, do religious practices matter? And I'll explain a little what I mean by that. From my outsider perspective on Christianity is that in Christianity, particularly Roman Catholicism, belief is very important, perhaps critical. Now, from my somewhat inside perspective on Judaism, I taught and let's believe what we actually believe as Jews is immaterial. It is what we do that matters. So my question for Neil is, do other religions have statements? Do they require belief or do they require actions?
Good question, Keith. What's your comment there, Neil?
Well, there's certainly a lot of variation across religions in how important belief is. In Christianity and I think Islam, there's a pretty high value placed on believing. But you're right. Other religious practices don't have the same strong emphasis on what you might call people's epistemological states. And that's fine. But nevertheless, I think my question is still interesting, which is, well, what is the psychological processing that goes on? Now, it may be that the less will hang on it when it comes to, say, contemporary Judaism than when it comes to contemporary Christianity. But there's still a lot of mental states that we have to account for in any given religion. So that's why a theory like mine is worthwhile.
So I want to ask you one quick question before we – I'm going to ask you like a big question, but one small question. John Wisdom had this old article, Gods, which was once required reading in the philosophy of religion, but it's kind of an old article. I don't know if they still read it. And he argues that religious beliefs started out as factual beliefs, right? But they lost in the competition with scientific explanation, and so they retreated – the religious retreated, withdrew their beliefs from the competition with science by making them non-empirical in a certain sense, right? But that's not a fundamental psychological divide. It's just that as factual beliefs, religious beliefs can't withstand the competition of so they could be held as factual beliefs, but they're just, if they're held as factual beliefs, they get refuted. So you retreat to another kind of way of holding these contents. What do you think of that thought?
Well, it's an interesting historical origin story, and I'm skeptical. So a great book that I recommend to everyone listening is Anne Taves' Revelatory Events, and she catalogs the origins of Mormonism. And the picture she paints is that there was a lot of creativity in kind of the invention of the Mormon religion. Joseph Smith had these visions, and then a small group kind of worked out together what to make of the visions. And it's an enormously creative process, and I can't honestly say I would think that it all started out as factual belief. It was the invention of a story.
Right. And that's another thing that distinguishes between everyday factual beliefs, right, and religious beliefs. So you can be a little bit more creative, a little bit more inventive in those contexts. But I want to ask you something about, you know, how the different communities should interact. I mean, how should non-believers think about religious beliefs, especially if we adopt your view that there's something anomalous, something special and unusual about religious beliefs? What kind of attitude should a non-believer have towards them?
I think the correct attitude is they're welcome in their place, but they're not welcome to govern public policy. So I think we should respect people's right to worship and to pray to the entities that they have religious credences about. But when those entities are taken to dictate public policy, right, like women's reproductive choices or how we take care of the environment, then the fact that religious credences aren't vulnerable to evidence, don't get shaped by evidence, means they're not properly used in the public sphere.
So you're with Rawls on this.
But I want to ask you a question really quickly, last question. Well, you're with Rawls on this, but Rawls faces a problem too, I think, because you said religious beliefs are tied up with identity. They play this identity-constituting role. Do you think all beliefs and allegiances that play an identity-constituting role should be banned from public policy, influencing the public square, so that I have to come to the public square without any kind of thick identity? That's one of the things I think is wrong with Rawls. It seems as though you're getting in the same boat.
I think any descriptive belief that's movable by evidence can be put in the public sphere, because then it can change when it's confronted with evidence.
But lots of identity-constituting beliefs aren't like that, right?
Well, sure. But I think lots of identity-constituting beliefs should also be left at the door, and we should, okay, we that's should what work I was on trying public to get values. You to say. Yeah.
And that's a feature for you, not a bug. But on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us, Neil. It's been a fascinating conversation, and I believe that, and not just religiously believe that.
Well, thank you, Ken. It's been great to be here.
Our guest has been Neil Van Leeuwen. He's a professor of philosophy at Georgia State University. He's working on a book tentatively entitled Religion as Make-Believe. So, Josh, you got any make-believe or genuine beliefs?
Well, God's been talking to me while you've been chatting, and here's what I think. So, I'm not sure I'd use the term make-believe exactly. I mean, people do kill for it and die for it, and in a way they don't for fictions. But it does, I accept Neil's point that it does seem to work a little bit differently from other beliefs. That doesn't mean it's not true. It certainly doesn't mean it isn't beneficial, right? It seems to do a lot of psychological work with people. As long as we keep it out of the policy-making sphere.
I'm not sure about that. I take Neil's point. I take your point. I think we would need to probe Neil of whatever. We did a little bit of this, but if we had another hour, I would have wanted to probe him on what other kinds of states belong in this way. Because in the same way that a religious community is a kind of fiction, so is a national community a kind of fiction. And those things are deadly serious. So I might write a book about serious fictions, you know what I mean?
Right.
But, you know, this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in our community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on our blog. Now, what does a religious belief sound like at the speed of thought? Let's ask Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, I can't speak to all religions, just the ones that pop up in the news, but it strikes me that they're all in a bit of trouble. They're defensive, allowing themselves to be defined by their enemies and by unbelievers, disbelievers, journalists, all of whom focus on the social implications of religion rather than its core beliefs. But even to itself, religion's core beliefs, so it seems to this observer, are being supplanted by self-image, which is increasingly dictated by the whispers and taunts of mass media or the internet or a mealy-mouthed congressional committee report. Let's take Israel. You can't criticize Israel without the risk of being accused of anti-Semitism. To complicate that, actual anti-Semites try to disguise their prejudice as criticism of Israel. And all the while, Netanyahu stands athwart history like a cut-rate colossus. See, I said cut-rate. That's a dog whistle because stereotypical Jews often offer discounts. Speaking of dog whistles, the Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, an actual Muslim, got elected and immediately became an object of scorn and accused of anti-Semitism because she said congresspeople take money from the Israel lobby in exchange for votes. It's all about the Benjamins, she said, which again is a dog whistle because stereotypical Jews, when not offering discounts, want to wallow in your money like Scrooge McDuck, a stereotypical dour and frugal Scot. Only a duck. Netanyahu, displaying the wit that has made him the toast to Paris Salon, told some Republicans that Ms. Omar is wrong. He is the only Benjamin because that's his first name. Ha ha ha. So, okay. Then Ms. Omar made a speech about prejudice against Muslims, in which, talking about 9/11, she described it or its aftermath as, quote, some people did something, unquote, which does not seem untrue, frankly, but she was chided for wearing her hijab and for not collapsing in tears, remorse, and regret any time 9/11 is even mentioned. Christians these days seem to wallow in this sort of Muslim bashing, even as they defend Israel, because it needs to be intact at the end times. Armageddon is the final battlefield, you see, which is in Israel. Israel has a robust relationship with American fundamentalist Christians because of this, but I don't know. It would make me a bit uneasy that an alliance is based on your country being the place for the final battle of all time, after which, unless you embrace Jesus, you'll be cast into a lake of fire, or its equivalent. Not my idea of a fun prayer breakfast. A guy named, I believe, Buttigieg is of this moment a rising possibility to be a Democratic candidate for president. He's married to a man and calls himself a gay Christian. Many Christians claim to be alarmed by that. Again, judging by what I see in the media, Christians today are against homosexuality, transsexuals, Muslims, public education, immigration, and the Clintons, though adultery is fine if you're Trump. Just the other day, Michelle Bachmann, former congresswoman from Minnesota and Christianity enthusiast, was interviewed by a Christian radio program. She said, among other things, quote, I will say to your listeners, in my lifetime, I have never seen a more biblical president than I have seen in Donald Trump, unquote. Not entirely sure what that means. Leviathan is biblical, I guess. Also Sodom and Gomorrah, I guess. I think she's trying to turn him into a latter-day prophet or something. For some reason, Trump seems to have a lot more mojo, religion-wise, than Obama or Bush or Reagan or even Jimmy Carter, who remains a Baptist, as far as I can tell, unlike President Trump, who has claimed to be a Christian, but it's not entirely convincing. He doesn't even know what Easter is, for instance. Interviewed 2 years ago, he said Easter, quote, really means something very special, unquote. And it's, quote, just a very important day, unquote. Hosanna, Hosanna, I guess, which comes from the Hebrew, save us, save us. From what is up for grabs, depending on who you ask. What do I know? I thought I knew Sikhs, for instance. I thought all Sikhs are cab drivers. Or rather, all the cab drivers in front of Ashby, Barton, Berkeley are Sikhs, until Uber goes public. Then all the cabs will disappear, the turbines will disappear, and then a year from that, Uber will disappear, and we'll have to take buses everywhere, but they're still running, which again is a sure sign of the end times. That's right. Even the end times have fallen in hard times and are running a little bit late. The Antichrist apologizes for the inconvenience. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2019.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Tina Pamantuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
You can't prove that there's no God.
You can't prove that there isn't a magic teapot floating around on the dark side of the moon with a dwarf inside of it that reads romance novels and shoots lightning out of its boobs, but it seems pretty unlikely, doesn't it?
Is God an evil dwarf?